Listener, after spending hours researching the darkest corners of true crime, sometimes you need something to help you decompress. That's where Mood comes in. Mood.com is an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC products right to your door. We're talking gummies, flower, pre-rolls, edibles. They've got products designed for specific vibes. Need to wind down after a heavy episode? They've got sleepy time gummies. Want something for focus during those long research sessions? They've got that too. They even have options for feeling euphoric or, let's say, enhancing other activities. Personally, I'm a fan of their Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies. They kick in fast and actually help quiet my brain after a long day of diving into cases. Everything ships discreetly. It's all backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And best of all, Obscura listeners get 20% off their first order. Head to mood.com and use code Obscura at checkout for 20% off. That's mood.com with code Obscura. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Here's the thing about the new year. You don't need to become a completely different person. Maybe you just need to feel a little lighter. We all carry stuff around. Doubt, old fears, pressure we put on ourselves. And sometimes it's hard to see what's actually weighing us down when you're the one carrying it. That's where therapy comes in. Having someone with an outside perspective can help you understand your patterns, your relationships, your motivations, the stuff that's harder to untangle on your own. BetterHelp has over 30,000 licensed therapists and has helped more than 5 million people. They match you based on a short questionnaire, and with over 12 years of experience, they typically get it right the first time. If not, you can switch therapists whenever you need to. Their average rating is 4.9 out of 5, based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp makes it easier to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Listener, we return to a narrative that resists closure, not because it lacks an ending, but because its consequences do not end where the body was found. This story is not about a single violent act isolated in time. It's about erosion. It is about how harm accumulates slowly, quietly, and with terrifying efficiency when no one intervenes. Consider the slow grinding down of stone by relentless water, the way flesh yields to persistent pressure, the way a child's trust dissolves under repeated betrayal, until only terror remains. It is about a child whose world narrowed inch by inch until nothing remained but fear, confinement, hunger, and pain. Imagine the gradual constriction of light in a closing room, the air growing thicker with unspoken dread, the small breaths becoming shallower as hope is starved alongside the body. It is also about the adult who inflicted that pain deliberately, repeatedly, and without interruption, and about the systems that looked away long enough for a small body to be destroyed in stages. Those systems, vast and impersonal, absorb reports like sand absorbs blood, leaving no trace, no urgency, no reckoning, until the evidence lies cold and irrefutable beneath indifferent bushes. In the previous installment, we outlined the early life of Anna Maria Cardona. That history matters not because it excuses what followed, but because it explains the architecture of damage that shaped her choices. It reveals how wounds, left untreated, calcify into weapons turned outward, how the victim learns the precise geometry of cruelty from those who first applied it. She was born in Cuba into abandonment. Her father left the day she entered the world. Her mother drank heavily and told her from early childhood that she was unwanted, stained, and responsible for the misery around her. These were not passing insults, listener, spoken in anger and forgotten. They were repeated messages, delivered often enough to become internal law. Each utterance etched deeper into the psyche, forming convictions as unyielding as bone, teaching a child that love is conditional upon perfection and that imperfection invites contempt. They taught her how to see herself and how to see others, to view vulnerability as provocation, dependence as accusation, a child's cry as an intolerable demand upon a fractured self. As she grew older, sexual violence entered her life. Rape was dismissed. harassment was normalized, suicide attempts brought no sustained help, no consistent care, no protection. Trauma accumulated without relief. There was no intervention to interrupt the pattern. Pain did not resolve. It hardened. It became something portable, a dark inheritance carried across oceans, festering in silence on a global scale, waiting for the moment when power shifted and the wounded could wound in return. When Cardona left Cuba, she crossed water, but not memory. Miami in the late 1980s offered no gentler structure. It was a city of extremes. Tourists drank rum under clean skies while cocaine money reshaped skylines. Immigrants crowded into small apartment efficiencies. Drugs flowed freely. Violence was common. Social services were overwhelmed or indifferent. In this environment, survival demanded hardness, a hardness bred in isolation, where cries for help echoed unanswered amid the roar of excess and despair. Cardona attached herself to Fidel Figueroa, a drug distributor whose money briefly provided insulation from consequence. That insulation vanished when Figueroa was murdered. He left behind an estate estimated at $100,000. It was large enough to feel endless and small enough to disappear quickly. The money funded cocaine, excess, and distraction. It did not fund stability. When it was gone, resentment replaced relief. Responsibility became unbearable. Children became burdens rather than dependents. Of all her children, the youngest carried the greatest weight of that resentment. He became the focal point for every loss, every deprivation, every echo of her own early rejection. His name was Lazaro Figueroa.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Lazaro was born into a household already fractured by addiction, instability, unresolved rage. From infancy, he was treated differently. He was left with strangers for extended periods. He was hidden when inconvenient. He was not nurtured. He was controlled. As months passed, that control escalated into violence. The abuse did not erupt suddenly, listener. It developed through repetition, through routine, through punishment administered so often that it lost any pretense of discipline and became ritual. With each blow, a reinforcement of dominance, each withholding of food, a lesson in power's indifference to suffering. When Lazaro's body was discovered on the morning of November 2nd, 1990, by Florida Power & Light employees in Miami Beach, it was not immediately identifiable. It had been placed deliberately beneath bushes, partially concealed, positioned between a tree and a garden wall several yards from any front entrance. It was close enough to human activity to be found eventually, but far enough from view to delay discovery. The choice of location suggested intent, not panic, a calculated abandonment, as if the perpetrator understood that time would erode evidence while distance eroded accountability. The condition of the body made clear that death was only the final event in a much longer process. Lazaro was severely malnourished. At 3 years old, he weighed approximately 18 pounds. His limbs were thin and wasted. His abdomen protruded from prolonged starvation. His skin hung loosely over bone, marked by bruises and multiple stages of healing. Some bruises were dark and swollen. Others had faded into yellow and green. The layering of color was a collage that hinted at prolonged anguish. The flesh told a chronicle of unrelenting assault, where new marks overlaid old, purple and yellow bloomed into flowering of sickly hues before fresh violence renewed the cycle. Dr. Bruce Heima, associate medical examiner, later testified that Lazaro had been bound, gagged, beaten, burned, and deprived of food over prolonged periods. This was not neglect alone. It was deliberate abuse. Photographs shown to the jury depicted a body saturated with trauma. His head and face were bloodied. His scalp bore evidence of blunt force injury. One leg appeared larger than the other due to swelling from injury. His diapers were soiled and secured with brown duct tape wrapped tightly around his waist. The tape pressed directly against skin. It was not loose. It was not temporary. It was applied to prevent removal, to contain excrement, and to eliminate the need for changing him. The adhesive bit into tender flesh, causing raw abrasions, where waste festered against wounds. The stench, a constant reminder of degradation imposed without mercy. Lazaro, this child, this baby, did not die from a single injury. He was physically abused over months and neglected over months. Malnutrition and anemia weakened his body to the point where healing was impossible. Injuries accumulated faster than recovery could occur. Dr. Haima cataloged the injuries with clinical precision. Repeated trauma to Lazaro's left arm caused the muscle tissue between the elbow and shoulder to ossify. Muscle had turned to bone. The arm became rigid, permanently bent at a 90-degree angle. It could no longer bend or function. This was not a birth defect. It was the result of repeated injury. Fractures knit wrongly in the absence of care. Tissue petrifying in agony, mocking the limb in eternal deformity as a testament to blows that shattered more than bone. Deep bruises on Lazaro's left hand and palm were consistent with defensive wounds. Even at 3 years old, he attempted to protect himself. His body was covered in bumps, bruises, and cigarette burns. Some burns were round, consistent with contact from a cigarette tip. The skin puckered and blistered. The pain seared through fragile nerves. Each application, a deliberate infliction of fire upon innocence. His skull had fractured. His brain had sustained injury. His left arm was frozen in place. Dr. Haima described the condition plainly. This was child torture. A systemic dismantling of a human being. A baby, piece by piece, in the privacy of domestic shadows. Despite suffering a fractured skull and brain injury, Lazaro may have lived for up to 3 days after being abandoned. Associate Medical Examiner Haima determined that the child had been dead less than 24 hours when discovered. This meant that after sustaining catastrophic injury, Lazaro lay alive, helpless, unattended, and in pain before death finally occurred. Alone beneath the bushes, insects crawling over open wounds, the sun beating down or the night chill seeping in, consciousness flickering amid swelling brain tissue and unrelenting thirst. The final cause of death was determined to be blunt force trauma to the head, inflicted by a baseball bat, compounded by starvation and extensive bodily trauma. Trial evidence demonstrated that Lazaro experienced approximately 18 months of sustained abuse while alive. Medical findings documented repeated fractures, including skull fractures accompanied by subdural and subarachnoid hematomas. His two upper front teeth had been knocked out. Some injuries were hours old, others days, others weeks or months old. His body functioned as a timeline of suffering, a living ledger of cruelty, where every mark recorded a moment when intervention failed and indifference prevailed. For weeks after the discovery, no one knew who he was, because his remains were unidentified. Local media referred to him simply as Baby Lollipops, a nickname derived from the cartoon candy pattern on the t-shirt he was wearing. The name stuck. The contrast was obscene. Bright colors against dirt. Childish imagery against visible neglect. The whimsical fabric clinging to a frame reduced to skeletal ruin, as if innocence mocked by its own adornment. Police appealed to the public using flyers and television broadcasts, deliberately withholding certain details, including the tape used on the diaper. On November 6th, Martha Flytus recognized the photograph on television and contacted authorities. She identified the child as Lazaro Figueroa, the son of Fidel Figueroa and Anna Maria Cardona. Other witnesses came forward. Betty Walker contacted the police early in the investigation. She recalled seeing Lazaro in North Miami Beach, malnourished, sometimes still wearing diapers, running across streets without supervision. His right arm was held stiffly against his body, as though in a sling. He appeared small for his age. He appeared unattended, a tiny figure navigating danger alone, the world vast and hostile around his diminished form. Mercedes Estrada lived at 8030 Abbott Avenue, apartment 2A, on Halloween night. She heard screaming from the neighboring apartment. The cries were high-pitched and frantic. They continued long enough to alarm her. Then came a heavy thump against the shared wall. a sound with weight behind it. The screaming stopped abruptly. The silence that followed was absolute. Estrada reported the incident to the Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services the following day. No response came. The report disappeared into the machinery of bureaucracy, swallowed by forms and files. Priorities shifted elsewhere, a child's agony reduced to paperwork that gathered dust. Weeks later, Miriam Ramos showed Estrada a flyer with photographs of two women. Estrada believed she recognized the child. On November 27th, Ramos brought Estrada to meet Detective Joseph Matthews at a Burger King. Matthews and Detective Trujillo went to the apartment and spoke with 14-year-old Gloria Pye. Tape similar to that found on Lazaro's diaper was discovered on the mailbox. Gloria stated she used it to keep the baby diaper in place. She cried. She confessed. She claimed she pushed him, that his head struck the wall, that he died. Her confession unraveled quickly, listener. She said a woman paid her $50 to babysit an unnamed boy for 2 weeks. She admitted to forgetting to feed him sometimes. She described wrapping tape around him. She claimed she was alone when he died. She said her mother and friend helped dispose of the body. Detective Matthews doubted her account almost immediately. None of what she described would explain away all the numerous injuries to the child. Gloria used Lazaro's name later in the conversation, despite investigators withholding it, and despite Gloria claiming she didn't know it. She described injuries not present on the body. Matthews thought that she was cognitively slow, frightened, possibly seeking attention or relief from fear. The next morning, Detective Gary Kluger drove her back. She asked questions about the difference between intentional and accidental actions. Police cleared her. The confession was false, common at this stage of an investigation. A desperate fabrication born of confusion and terror, and the shadow of greater culpability. Obscura is brought to you by True Diagnostic. Chronological age is your birthday. Biological age is how old your body really is. True Diagnostic gives you your biological age and health markers, plus a simple, personalized 90-day plan after analyzing over 1 million data points. Biological age is the strongest predictor of disease, risk, and mortality. True Age measures biological age versus chronological age and your current pace of aging. It includes symphony age, tracking the health of 11 organ systems, heart, brain, lungs, immune system, etc. It gives your top three aging actions you can take to slow or reverse aging. 86% of True Age users who follow the plan reduce their biological age. Order online and the kit ships right to your door. It's a quick, simple finger prick at home, then drop it in the prepaid return package. Your only job, follow the three recommendations for 90 days, then retest to see the progress. It uses advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million biomarkers, identifying the three most important actions you take over 90 days to improve your health. Trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, my listeners get 20% off TrueDiagnostic.com using code Obscura20 at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code Obscura20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. Listener, Chime is changing the way people bank. Fee-free and smarter banking built for you. Not like old-school banks that charge you overdraft and monthly fees. No, listener, it's built for you, not the 1%. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. Some old banks still can't do this. And forget overdraft fees, minimum balance fees, and monthly fees. Chime turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. And you can stack the benefits. Bank fee-free plus overdraft coverage you can count on, and it helps you build your credit history stress-free. Earn up to 3.5% APY on savings, 8 times higher than traditional banks. I love Chime. My younger self would have benefited from this. Chime is not just smarter banking. It is the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It takes just a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/obscura. That is chime.com/obscura.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Timing depends on submission of payment file. Fees apply at out-of-network ATMs. Bank ranking and number of ATMs according to U.S. News and World Report 2023. Chime checking account required.
Investigators turned to school records. Juan Puente was enrolled first in South Miami, then in St. Cloud near Orlando. Detectives waited at the school. This was pre-everyone being online, listener. It wasn't the easiest thing in the world to find people. Sometimes you had to track them down, especially if they didn't want to be found. I know that sounds absurd today when there are cameras everywhere, from the sky to lampposts, but this was a different time. I just wanted to draw attention to that. Anna Cardona and Olivia Gonzalez Mendoza arrived to pick him up. Olivia was aggressive and confrontational. Detective Santiago informed Anna that Lazaro was dead. She cried. She said she had left him with a woman. They were arrested and transported to the sheriff's office. Santiago questioned why a mother would leave a three-year-old with a mentally ill teenager. Anna initially described an elegant woman met in a restaurant. This did not match the description of Gloria. Matthews interrogated her with Santiago translating. Anna repeatedly asked about her other children. Matthew left to retrieve a recorder. When he returned, he was greeted with a strange image. Anna was on her knees. She was crying, kissing Santiago's feet. Matthews later stated he did not understand the scope of this case at that moment. This was a lesson in how bad the job could get. Anna's formal statement came 7 hours after arrest. She claimed Lazaro injured himself jumping off a bed. She said she attempted to revive him. She said Olivia helped. She said she feared police would take her children. She suggested leaving Lazaro on the doorstep of a wealthy home. She claimed he was alive when abandoned. They fled to St. Cloud. She denied most injuries. She mentioned a slight limp. She begged not to lose custody, and she never asked about Lazaro or his condition when they found him. Olivia Gonzalez Mendoza provided a different account, listener. The apartment was filthy. The mattress was soaked with urine. Lazaro was kept in a closet. He was beaten for wetting the bed, despite never being potty trained. Diapers went unchanged for days. The smell overwhelming, putrid, sickly sweet. A miasma of decay that permeated walls and lungs, evidence of prolonged confinement and filth. Anna was known to yank Lazaro's arm violently when she was angry with him. Breaks occurred repeatedly. She would punch his face. She pulled his hair. She'd drag him upstairs by it. On the day of Lazaro's death, Olivia opened the closet. The little boy screamed when he saw his mother behind her. The reaction was immediate and involuntary. He was terrified of Anna, a Pavlovian recoil, the mere sight triggering primal dread conditioned by months of torment. Olivia threatened him with a baseball bat to silence him. Anna took the bat. Olivia believed Anna taped Lazaro's mouth and returned him to the closet. When Olivia returned from bathing, Anna said she had killed him. Lazaro lay motionless, staring blankly, paper stuffed in his mouth. They attempted revival with alcohol and water. It failed. Anna dressed him, wrapped him in a bedsheet, and insisted on dumping the body. Olivia suggested taking him to a hospital. Anna called her crazy and a snitch. They drove toward Miami Beach. Anna removed the child from the car and left him in the bushes of a wealthy-looking estate. Gonzalez Mendoza later pled guilty to second-degree murder and aggravated child abuse. She served nearly 17 years of a 40-year sentence. She was released in 2008. Over 18 months, Anna Cardona beat, choked, starved, confined, emotionally abused, and systematically tortured Lazaro. He was tied to a bed, bound, gagged, left in bathtubs with extreme water temperatures, and locked in closets. Scalding or freezing liquid searing skin already raw from bindings, the shock amplifying helplessness. Tape wrapped around his diaper to contain waste and avoid changing him. He was beaten with belts, shoes, and hangers. He was bitten. He was thrown against walls. On the day of death, he was beaten with a baseball bat after soiling himself. Lazaro did not die from a fall. He died from fear and impact. When Anna returned, he screamed instantly. This, listener, was a conditioned response. Anna struck him repeatedly. The blows were so hard, they caused diffuse axonal injury. His right arm fractured as he tried to defend himself. His skull fractured. His teeth were dislodged from his mouth. 43 injuries were documented. His life was defined by pain. Every breath taken in anticipation of the next strike. Every moment, a calculation of survival. The case became known nationally as the Baby Lollipops Murder. After abandoning Lazaro's body, Cardona and Gonzalez fled to Central Florida, stopping at Disney World for a quick vacation. A grotesque juxtaposition of whimsy and horror, laughter echoing amid memories of screams. Anna Cardona was sentenced to death in 1992. The conviction overturned in 2002 due to a Brady violation. She was sentenced to death again in 2011. That conviction was overturned in 2016 due to prosecutorial misconduct. In 2017, prosecutors waived the death penalty. Cardona testified, denied abuse, and blamed Olivia. The jury rejected her account. She was sentenced to life without parole. Judge Diaz stated that injury followed injury from toes to brain. He said animals show more empathy than this quote-unquote mother did to her son. The trials stretched across decades. Trauma was cited, did not absolve. Choices were made daily. Each decision a reaffirmation of cruelty over compassion, erosion complete. Anna remains in prison to this day. Her children are grown. Juan Puenta, her first son, died in 2018 at age 37. Tahimi has disappeared from public view. Miami changed. The closet empty. The beaches remain bright. The only photograph of Lazaro available online is of him dead. We do not know his favorite food. We do not know his favorite song. We don't even know his smile. These ordinary joys denied, erased by the magnitude of suffering imposed. In their place stands only the stark image of ruin, a small form laid bare under forensic lights, ribs protruding like accusations, skin mottled with the chronology of cruelty. That single captured moment of death has become his eternal portrait, circulated across decades. A digital relic that outlives any memory of vitality. No snapshot exists in public view of him toddling unsteadily. No frozen laugh from a birthday song. No candid glimpse of eyes wide with wonder rather than dread. The world possesses him only in extremity, reduced to evidence. His humanity compressed into the grotesque stillness of autopsy tables and courtroom projections. This absence is itself a final violation, a theft that extends beyond the grave, ensuring that even in remembrance, he remains defined by violation rather than by the simple, irreplaceable spark of a child's unburdened existence. Lazaro knew only fear at the sight of his mother, listener. He was only 3 years old. Contemplate that final conditioned recoil, the involuntary scream that rose unbidden when her shadow fell across the closet door. In those brief years allotted to him, the maternal figure, source of solace in any sane order of things, had been transmuted into an architect of terror. Every approach signaled impending pain, every voice a prelude to blows, or confinement, or the slow ache of hunger. The bond that nature intends as sanctuary became instead a mechanism of torment, twisting the most fundamental human attachment into a source of unrelenting horror. At an age when other children seek arms for comfort, he learned to associate them with restraint, with bindings that cut into flesh, with the yank of hair or the swing of improvised weapons. His short life was a prolonged lesson in betrayal, where the person obligated to shield him from the world's harshness instead embodied its cruelest indifference. This perversion strikes at the root of what we claim to hold sacred, exposing the fragility of protections we assume innate. It reveals how readily the impulse to nurture can invert into destruction when unchecked by conscience or consequence, leaving a child to navigate a private hell disguised as home. This is the record, a somber indictment of what humanity permits in its hidden corners, where small lives are extinguished slowly and the world proceeds unmoved. Consider the depth of that permission, listener. The vast complacency that allows such erosion to proceed unseen, unhindered. In this lattice of indifference, cruelty found fertile ground, accumulating day by day, bruise upon bruise, deprivation upon deprivation, until a fragile body could bear no more. Lazaro remains frozen in that single, posthumous image, his brief existence distilled into a cautionary specter, haunting databases and documentaries alike. A boy who could have chased waves on that same bright beach, who might have known the taste of simple pleasures, the sound of laughter untinged by fears. Instead, his world contracted to corners and closets, to the sting of bindings and the gnaw of emptiness. His final hours, perhaps days, spent alone amid foliage, consciousness ebbing amid insects in isolation, the vast indifference of nature mirroring the human failure that deposited him there. This is the abyss we confront when we peer into such records. Not merely the monstrosity of individual acts, but the monstrous ease with which they are accommodated. Thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.
Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's MOOD.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. Every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust, delivered discreetly, and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to mood.com, that's M-O-O-D.com, to get started.